Thanks so much for your really warm welcome, folks. Thanks for your smiling faces. I've heard about this place from way back from Paul Friend down through the years. And so it's actually lovely to be with you this morning. Really appreciate the welcome. Really appreciated Sammy's kindness and communication on the way through. Well, this morning, I thought it would be a fantastic thing to launch off from the wonderful talk that we just heard, thinking about mustard seeds, that actually we're gonna think about exactly that, which is amazing, the way God brings these things together. And I'm going to start by showing you a little video just to expand our brains outward, and then we're going to start sort of cosmic, massive, and then we're going to shrink down to the very personal. Does that sound like a good journey? Okay, have a listen.
A group of spies once tried to trap Jesus, asking, "Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar?" In other words, are you a revolutionary opposed to Roman rule, or are you a compromiser supporting Roman rule? He refuses to be tricked into giving a simplistic answer and instead asks for a coin, asks his own question, and then famously declares, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and render unto God what is God's." Now, we hear those words with our Western mindsets and think, ah, easy. Let Caesar look after all the practical, logistical, political stuff, and let God and his people get on with all the spiritual stuff. The Sunday morning stuff, prayers, hymns, invisible things, that's God's turf. Taxation, roads, healthcare, that's Caesar's turf. How convenient to have that separation. None of that awkward mixing of religion and politics. But for those listening to Jesus in the first century, there's not a chance they would have heard Jesus' statement that way. For the Hebrews, body, soul, and spirit were not separate entities. Life was one. For example, the temple wasn't just a place where you worshipped. It was a civic centre, looking after many aspects of communal life. For the Hebrews, their religious leaders were also their political leaders. So when we talk about what is God's and what is Caesar's, we're not talking about two separate realms where God has jurisdiction in the sacred and Caesar has jurisdiction in the secular. It's not like this. It's more like this. Caesar has a small delegated area of authority within the context of God's overall authority. He is the supreme creator who is reconciling all things in heaven and earth to himself. Jesus reiterated this when he told Pilate that he would have no authority unless it had been given you from above. Note that he doesn't dispute that Pilate has real authority, but he reminds him where it comes from. So God has an opinion on everything, including taxes, because he is in authority over all of it. As the ex-Dutch Prime Minister and theologian Abraham Kuyper said, "There is not one square inch of creation over which the Lord Christ does not cry, 'It is mine.'"
Amen. That's quite a profound statement if we do believe that. There is not one square inch of creation over which the Lord Christ does not cry, "It is mine." He has authority over it all. Therefore, he cares about it all. Therefore, he has opinion on it all, that we make a real mistake when we separate the secular and the sacred. As has often been said, the only thing actually secular is sin. There is nothing secular. I try to not use the word secular most of the time. I use the word mainstream if I'm trying to describe a mainstream radio station or a mainstream publication. I'm not sure the word secular is actually all that helpful. Mark Green, who leads the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity, Mark has a wonderful saying where he says that in every decade since the Second World War, a different theologian has won the theological debate about the sacred-secular divide. That in every decade, you look at John Stott, you look at Stanley Horvath, you look at New Begin, you look at all these theologians, you can go all the way through the last few decades and somebody has won that debate, blown the secular-sacred divide out of the water. He says, and that has happened in every single decade, but it has never led to a functional change in the church. Challenging words. That actually, if you look at where we spend our money and where we spend our time, you could be forgiven for thinking that actually our primary role is to put on the best show possible on a Sunday morning, rather than caring about the rest of the world, rather than caring about taxation, bins, broadband, the environment. this we say. We now have this holistic theology of the kingdom, don't we? Where we do give assent to the importance of all those things and seeing all of creation transformed and restored and redeemed and reconciled to its creator. But when you look at where we spend our time and our staffing levels and our money, does it actually portray that? Or are we releasing our people to be the salt and light that he calls us to in those places? So it's a big picture. It's a big picture. God has a passion for all of it, for the breadth of his creation. But if you're anything like me, and you live in an internet age where we are constantly aware of the challenges and the problems in our own community, in our society, and in the whole world, as Roz led us so beautifully in those prayers, there is so much going on in the world. And we are now, in our generation, so constantly connected to it, because we're connected to it via the media, via social media, via news media. We are constantly aware of all the carnage going on, and therefore we start to get just a little bit, we start to just fall down. We start to believe that this epic tale, this world that seems to be coming apart, that starts to really rest on our shoulders, and we fall and we go, oh my goodness, we've got to be doing that, and we've got to be doing that, and we've got to be doing that, and we've got to be doing that. And then you got somebody like me coming and saying, yes, God cares about it all. God cares about everything. Doesn't just care about our personal salvation. He cares about the animals. He cares about trafficking. He cares about fostering. Oh, we've got to be into trafficking. Oh my God, we've got to be into fostering. Oh, we've got to be into poverty. Oh, we've got to have a food bank. And people all around the country are just going, oh, we're tired. We're exhausted. The world's in a bad place, and I feel like God's passionate about all this stuff, and therefore we've got to be passionate about all this stuff. Right, into that situation, into that reality, comes these incredible verses that were read for us this morning. These incredible verses in John chapter 5, which seem to do something a little bit different, which seem to speak about something a little bit different. These verses, forgive my phone for misbehaving just for a moment. These incredible verses in John chapter 5 come with a slightly different story. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. In his defense, Jesus said to them, my Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working. For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him, not only because he was breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. And Jesus gave them this answer. Very truly, I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. This is the same Jesus who talked about us having an easy yoke and a light burden. And if you look at the state of the world, you think, well, how is it realistic for us to have an easy yoke or a light burden when you look at the state of the planet? And you're telling me that we need to be caring about politics as well, Andy, and you need to be caring about education, and you need to be caring about healthcare. Well, that's just too much. I want to draw you a little Venn diagram. Did anybody enjoy Venn diagrams at school? So you've already seen one Venn diagram that I hope is useful, you know, thinking about how it's not like this, you know? It's not like God and Caesar having separate jurisdictions, but actually, you know, Caesar having this small area of delegated authority within God's overall authority. Is that a helpful thought? You know, it affirms earthly authority. It affirms the importance of earthly authority. It affirms, as Romans does and as other parts of the New Testament do, it affirms earthly authority to govern, to make sure that we don't live in a world of chaos. It affirms that authority, but it reminds that authority fair and square where it comes from. And I saw this in operation. I don't know if you heard about the National Prayer Breakfast a couple of years ago. I had the privilege of being in the middle of what happened there when Sajid Javid resigned at tea time after being at the National Prayer Breakfast. And what happened at the prayer breakfast was incredible. A gentleman, Les Isaac, who you may know from starting the Street Pastors Network, spoke, but he stopped 4 minutes early. And I felt, well, this is an opportunity. I was about to lead a song, and I thought, you know what, we could just leave some space and see what God wants to do here. And I was working with a wonderful cellist called Lucy Clasper, and Lucy just played and played and played. We had 190 MPs there that morning, more than we've ever had there before. And at the start of this, at the service, I'd said, look, you know what? It's not often you get to sing Angels in the Heights Adore Him when there actually are angels above in the rafters of Westminster Hall, reminding those who walk and work below where ultimate authority lies. That's just quite a scary thing to say to Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer and Justin Welby when they're stood in front of you. Reminding them where ultimate authority lies. And that morning, I genuinely believe more people than normal were recognizing that ultimate authority. And so something profound happened as Lucy played during those 4 or 5 minutes. You could feel it. The whole place, the atmosphere was electric. I drove home shaking. I was ringing my wife saying, "Darling, I don't know what happened. Something really mad happened this morning." And Sajid Javid hadn't come to the breakfast before, but he was there that morning. And at tea time, he resigned and said, "I can't with any integrity stand anymore as part of this." And you know the story. You know, those were the dominoes that then led to Boris Johnson resigning later on the next week. God did something quite incredible that morning. He reminded people where ultimate authority lies. And sometimes in the midst of our news stories, we forget where ultimate authority lies. We forget where ultimate authority lies. So that's one Venn diagram to take home. Is that okay? Let's not forget that one. But another one to take home is Jesus here in this passage saying he can only do what he sees the Father doing. He only does what he sees the Father doing. So I want you to think of this whole full set of a Venn diagram being like everything that Jesus could have done during his life on earth. Every village he could have sorted out. Every piece of local politics he could have sorted, every healing that he could have done, every deliverance that he could have done, every word of truth that he could have spoken to somebody. This is everything that Jesus could have done during his earthly ministry, okay? And then this is what he did do. He didn't heal everyone in the village. He didn't go to every village. That's what he did. Jesus very clearly said he only did what he saw the Father doing. He only spoke what he heard the Father calling him to say. If you need any more convincing, John 12 says, "For I did not speak on my own, but the Father who sent me commanded me to say all that I have spoken. I know that his command leads to eternal life. So whatever I say is just what the Father has told me to say." Then on further on in John 16, "But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth. He will not speak on his own. He will only speak what he hears, and he will tell you what is yet to come. He will glorify me, because it is from me that he will receive what he will make known to you." Jesus isn't just doing things randomly. He isn't just doing everything that could be done. He's only doing what he sees the Father doing. And his disciples are going, "Hey, Jesus, it's going really well in this village. You're so popular. Let's do a bit more. Stay here. This is going really well." And he says, "No, we're going on. No, I'm disappearing. I need to spend time in solitude with my Father." "Oh, no, Jesus, but look, it could be great. It could be great. This is a really strategic place." "No, I'm going on. I'm only doing what I see the Father doing. I'm only speaking what I hear the Father telling me to speak." Jesus was in this constant communion with his Father that meant that he could just do the rifle thing rather than what I tend to do, which is the shotgun thing. You know, we live in a functional age. We live in a utilitarian age where really only what works matters. If something's successful, that's what we care about. When something works, that's what we care about. We are caught in this function, and so it's so tempting to be people of function, to be people who are so committed just doing the thing that works, doing the thing in front of us that will make us feel like we're doing, at least we're doing something. We enjoy just getting our instructions. I would rather get my programming at the start of the year, at the start of the week, at the start of the day, and I'll just do that. Give me my to-do list and I'll go through and I'll tick those boxes off. Rather than the more challenging thing of being constantly in communion with our Father so that in any given day we know what he is nudging us and whispering us to do, and to know from that constant communion what we see him doing, seeing him at work, seeing him in the invisible, in the conversation on the street, in the person at the school gates, seeing what he is doing and joining him in that. And that's why I believe Jesus talked about having an easy yoke and a light burden, because it doesn't mean having to meet every need in the village. We can get so burdened thinking that it's our job to meet every need. And I don't know where we get that from, because it's not the way Jesus lived his life. Now, absolutely, God will call us to meet needs and to be organized and not just meet them individually, but maybe set up a program or a project to help meet needs. Yes, he will call us to it, but boy, do we need to be constantly checking in constant communion with him that it is what he is calling us to here and now, that it's what he's calling us to now, today, that it's not just our instructions from 5 years ago that we're just sitting resting on. Are we in that constant communion? Because to be honest, I think this Venn diagram, if that's what the Venn diagram looks for Jesus, looks like for Jesus, then I think that's what the Venn diagram should look like for me. And the beautiful thing is that that's what the Venn diagram will look like for me, but then that's what the Venn diagram will look like for Sammy, that's what it'll look like for Richard, that's what it'll look like for Janet, that's what it'll look like for, and gradually with all our little things that we're called to, it does something beautiful. There's a kingdom expression. There's a wonderful thing that has happened. The kingdom is demonstrated by these beautiful little moments of being in sync with the Father. And I see this happen in politics all the time. I see people who feel like they've joined the right party, who they write for all the right websites, they've read all the right stuff, but nothing really seems to happen for them. And then there are people who I know who are just fervent in prayer and on their knees, and these ridiculous things seem to happen. They get given crazy favor. They happen to bump into a prime minister in the middle of a meeting. They happen to bump into somebody else of note who they can influence. There are stories in the book of people like that who have just been in the right place at the right time. And we shouldn't be surprised about that. You know, we often, people who are making the case for Christians being involved in politics often talk about Daniel and Joseph and Esther and all those great Old Testament characters who we know were involved in some pretty shocking regimes. Yet God called them to be involved on the inside, in the middle of it all. But what we often forget when we quote those folks as examples is that the reason that they were elevated to those positions of favor was usually to do with something pretty supernatural happening. It was a dream. It was an interpretation of a dream. It was being in exactly the right place at the right moment to meet the right person. It was the constant communion with the Father, that connectedness, that rootedness that allowed the miraculous and the wonderful to happen. That yes, our call is broad and massive and wide. It's about taxation, it's about climate change, it's about trafficking, it's about everything. But our specific call to it may well be very, very small. And it's more to do with that constant communion and that connection. I'm going to draw another diagram. I get concerned in our functional age. Oh, losing it. I get concerned in our functional age that we get so passionate and rightly passionate about the state of our world that we start getting lapsing into this sort of lazy language of what I would call people talking about building the kingdom, that it's our job to build the kingdom. And it's like, we just have to do this. We feel like, well, if we get that sorted, and then we'll get that next thing sorted, and then we'll get that sorted, then we'll get that sorted, and yes, and we'll get that thing sorted, and then gradually, we'll gradually get these things till we get to this future perfection. You know, this future sort of progressive utopia that is just a shadow of God's perfect future. And we start to think that actually by our own efforts, we will build that thing. And you know, you think maybe that's not the way your mind works, but believe me, the young people of this nation, especially some of the young people of the church of this nation, that is the way people have started to think, thinking, well, God doesn't care about that stuff as much. I mean, how do you care about that when God is passionate about poverty? God is passionate about marriage, God is passionate about all these things. Well, you're saying, well, it's not just about sorting out the practical. It's about everything. He cares about the internal as well. It's not just building the kingdom. I think a better way to draw it is what we're called to do is not building the kingdom, but demonstrating the kingdom. So there are moments of absolute beauty, moments of kindness, moments of good legislation, but we may well have bad moments as well. Our lives show this. There'll be moments of just illustration, beautiful demonstration. And then we do know, thankfully, that it ends up here, that we get to this place of perfection, the new heavens and the new earth, where everything is restored and redeemed and reconciled to its creator, and that everything is just glorious. We know that's where we're headed, but let's face it, we don't really know exactly how that happens. But we know that is our future. We know that's the end of the story. So what we're involved in right here and right now is not trying to build to get there. We're just doing what Jesus did. We're demonstrating moments of beauty, moments of faithfulness, moments of justice, moments of compassion. We're there to demonstrate the kingdom, not build it. We don't have to sort out everyone in the village. We're there to demonstrate a better way. The best way I can describe this is to leave maths behind and go to chemistry. My chemistry classes, I had a mad chemistry teacher called Mr. Semple, who used to just pour ether on desks and set it on fire. And he would do these incredible experiments with sodium, magnesium, potassium, where you just expose it to the oxygen. A lot of you are nodding with great pleasure remembering this. And they would just spark different colors. When you know, like copper went green, and potassium went purple, did it? And magnesium, and then you expose these little bits of metal to the oxygen, and they would just go like fireworks. Because that I think that is where the color of fireworks comes from. And that was, those actual experiments were called a demonstration. It was a chemistry demonstration experiment. It was a demonstration because, yes, it's happening. Sodium oxide is being formed. Magnesium oxide is being formed. It's real. It's a real thing. But it's happening at a much smaller scale to what we're actually learning about, which is what happens in some big industrial plant somewhere, what chemical reactions are going on in sort of heavy industry. We are just doing that as a demonstration for how those metals and how those oxides are formed in a big industrial process. And in the same way, Jesus' miracles, when Jesus healed somebody, when he delivered somebody, it was real. It's not that it was just a kind of a little advert. It was real. Their lives were transformed. People were healed. The magnesium oxide was formed. It was real. But it was also just a demonstration of the future perfection that we're stepping into. It was a demonstration, and that's what we're called to. We're called to little moments of fireworks, of demonstration, of sparks that show that perfect future, that make people go, oh, maybe there's another way, that make people sit up and go, oh, wow. We're called to little moments of demonstration, not having to take everything on ourselves, but being so deeply connected that we are able to be doing only what we see the Father doing and what we hear him telling us to do and what we hear the Spirit whispering us to do. These moments that express the beauty of the new creation in the same way that Jesus did. You know, I'll never forget being in a meeting that we'd started. We just started this new thing in Parliament, and it was very exciting. We had like 200 people crammed into a room, which only should have had about 80 people. And we just got a new website going. And, you know, there were I can't remember like how many. It was something like, in the past 3 or 4 days since we set up the White House, we had like 40, 50,000 hits on the website. There was great enthusiasm. There was great excitement. People were like getting, yes, there was real energy in the room. It was wild. And as I prayed that afternoon as to what I should share, I felt God really speak to me quite profoundly. And ironically, that meeting in Parliament was on November the 5th, which if you know your history, is an interesting evening to have a meeting in Parliament. And I literally felt God say to me that afternoon, you know, there are people coming this evening and they're expecting fireworks. You know, they're expecting something spectacular to happen, that change will happen fast, and that there'll be something. And, you know, and we had the website and we had the videos and we had everything. They wanted to be shiny and spectacular. And I felt God say to me, do you know, the same was true in first century Palestine. They were expecting fireworks. They were expecting fireworks. They wanted liberation from the Romans. They wanted a military overthrow. They wanted a spectacular restitution for the nation of Israel. In first century Palestine, they were expecting fireworks. And what they got was a bloke talking about a mustard seed. The smallest little thing. Are we prepared for the small, hard yards of these moments, these little moments of fire, these mustard seed moments of fireworks that might not seem significant, that will not get into anybody's newsletter, that will not be shared widely on social media, but are these beautiful moments of communion with our Father that expose us and expose the world to the beauty of his kingdom? Are we up for that? Does that sound like a more appealing welcome than having to sort out all the needs of the village? This call to constant communion with him. And for each of us, that will look like different things. I mean, the best way I can explain this is the excitement that I would feel on a Saturday afternoon. It was the highlight of my week when I was a kid, because it was the moment my dad would come into the house and say, Andrew, it's time for you to help me wash the car. And I would swell with pride because, you know, my dad needed my help to wash the car. I used to get all my little yellow cagoule, get suds in the bucket and sponge, and I used to love it. It was glorious, gorgeous memory. That was until a few years ago. I was sat in a church on a Sunday morning, and the preacher was talking about how he'd been washing his car with his son the previous day. And I sat up in my seat going, oh, I remember this. Oh, I was having this sort of warm, fuzzy memory. It was gorgeous. And he said, yeah, I was washing the car with my son yesterday. And you know what? It was a nightmare. He got a stone in the sponge and he scraped the paintwork. He kicked the bucket over. And we had to keep refilling the bucket. The whole process took a lot longer than it would have if I had just done it myself. And I was just like, oh. this carpet was pulled out from underneath my beautiful memory. And I was thinking, I was only 5 or 6 at the time. I'm sure I probably could only reach the bumper. And I'm sure the bits that I was washing didn't get washed particularly well. And it left me thinking, well, why did my dad ask for my help washing the car? Because I'm sure I made the process take a lot longer. But beautifully, it came to me slowly, as it's already come to you, I'm sure, that my dad simply wanted my help washing the car because he wanted me to be where he was. He wanted me to be getting up to what he was already getting up to. He wanted to be getting to know me in the context of a shared task. And you see the analogy, don't you? That all across this world, I believe our Heavenly Father is healing the sick and bringing sight to the blind and releasing the oppressed. And he simply calls us to be getting up to what he's already getting up to. Getting to know him in the context of a shared task. In as much as you've done it to the least of my brethren, you've done it unto me. We meet God in the hands and the eyes and the faces of the poor and the marginalized and the lonely rich of our world. We meet him there because that is where he is at work. We get to know him. We get to know his broken, beating heart for this broken world. We feel his heart. We feel and we understand because he knows that this whole story is as much about his mission in us as it is our mission through us. In our functional superhero ways, we want it to be about, well, what we can achieve. And he's saying, come and do this with me so that you can learn my heart, so you can learn how I do this. Look at the beautiful way it's expressed in John 5. My Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working. Very truly, I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all he does. Yes. And he will show him even greater works than these, so that you will be amazed. For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whom he is pleased to give it. It was an incredibly sobering thing for me to realize that my dad did not need my help. But it was an incredibly beautiful thing to realize that my dad did want my help. And that is the relationship of love that we're invited into this morning. Not a functional thing to just, I need some army people to help me sort out this world. I need it. It's a relationship of love that we are called into. Come, partner with me. Come, experience this with me. Incredibly, even though we get into a very dodgy theological cul-de-sac when we start to believe that our help is needed. You know, I believe in a sovereign God, as we talked about, who is sovereign over all of creation, who could just click his fingers and do anything he wants to transform anything he wants in this world. Yet incredibly, it would appear his method of choice is to partner with us, to be involved in it, so that we are actually getting to experience who he is and we are getting to know him, because it's all about getting to know him as much as it is about seeing transformation in this place. That's the relationship of love that we are called into. That is the journey of being daughters and sons of the living God, of realizing that we are not needed, but also experiencing some of the freedom and the relaxation of knowing that we are not needed, knowing the light burden, the easy yoke of not being needed, but the joy of being wanted and of being invited into that story, being invited into those places where we perhaps may be able to demonstrate those moments of beauty, of transformation, of good legislation, of thankfulness.